Welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club. We are a community of practitioners focused on helping your clients achieve meaningful and socially significant behavior change. This is your host, Matt Harrington.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. Today we're going to be going over trends in reporting procedural integrity, a comparison. This was published in BAP in 2023 by Hahn and colleagues. So this is an interesting one because what we're looking at here is the amount of times that procedural integrity was reported in our flagship Journal of Applied Behavior Analysis, as well as Behavior Analysis and Practice and Journal of Organizational Behavior Management. They also did a really interesting look at omission and commission errors and which of those was likely to be reported. But to be completely honest, I don't really care about the amount of times it was reported in these articles. No, what I care about more is what procedural fidelity and treatment fidelity mean to us as a behavior analyst. So we are going to review the article, but just know that because I'm keeping this podcast super zoomed in on the practical, what can I do when I start my workday in about 30 minutes if you're commuting, I'm keeping it very focused on the what it means for practitioners part and their recommendation section that's fairly robust and includes data sheets, and not on the JABA has increased 3% in procedural fidelity, or whatever the number is. So what is procedural integrity, fidelity data, etc.? It's the independent variable being applied as described by the behavior analyst. A really simple example, right? If you're doing escape extinction or attention extinction or something like that, the intervention is designed that contingent on a behavior, attention is not applied. Contingent on a behavior, escape is not applied. So there's two kinds of errors that we could have in fidelity. We could have contingent on a behavior, attention is applied, right? So that would be an error of commission, where you're providing something into the environment that's creating the error. Or on the other side, if you're doing like a differential reinforcement of an alternative behavior, like a functional communication response, then an error of omission would mean contingent on the functional communication response, escape is not applied. So that's an error of omission. In commission, we're putting something in. In omission, we're forgetting to put something in. That's the basis of procedural integrity. There's a lot of barriers to perfect fidelity. And as scientists who focus on the natural environment and the effects that the environment has on our clients and caregivers, fidelity is kind of a big deal. So these barriers are fairly important. One of the things that I do before I start any case and as I'm working through cases is start to identify that's going to be a challenge, that's going to be a challenge, there's going to be a struggle there. I'm looking ahead to all of these barriers and trying to catch them before they come up. And to be honest, oftentimes fidelity is one of the things I'm pointing to the most. Let's say I walk into an intake and I have a caregiver who is pushing 75 to 80, and the client I'm working with is 6 years old, loves to run around and climb, and they're happy, relaxed, and engaged is running around playing tag, climbing on a jungle gym. There's going to be a barrier there, right? Because the caregiver is likely not going to be able to catch up to that five-year-old. So that separation, that simple identification there, is going to be a barrier to fidelity. What that points to, perhaps, is a lack of competency by the implementers, or a lack of being able to put in the independent variable as described by the implementer, the end user. In this case, this would be the caregiver, possibly a grandparent. But also, it could be your technician. Let's say you just onboarded two or three new clients who engage in high magnitude self-injurious behavior, and you yourself have the competence, the skill set to work with that behavior, but your technician is fresh off of the 40-hour course. They're probably not going to have the skill set to deal with that themselves yet. Another barrier is a lack of staff or just attention to detail. So when I say lack of staff, oftentimes fidelity ends up getting more and more complicated the more people you have involved in the intervention. I know as a clinician, one of the things that you have to deal with in the real world outside of research is the fact that there are sometimes many people on your treatment teams. You may be having 3 behavioral interventions running for this client, and then you have 6 different techs, 7 different techs, all working with that same client. Fidelity gets real messy there. It's really hard for you as a supervisor to be able to be everywhere all at once all the time. And finally, the last barrier is simply lack of skills by the supervisor. And that's what this article really hopes to address in the recommendation section, is that sometimes supervisors just haven't been taught how to take fidelity data or procedural integrity data. And it's really not that hard. It just takes time. It takes a little bit of extra attention, and hopefully that's what this article will help you see the importance of. Now, in research, procedural integrity has been slowly increasing in popularity and is becoming more and more necessary for research. When I was completing my capstone, we had to basically write a research paper, and one of the things that was a necessity if we were doing an intervention was having procedural integrity data there. So it's fairly common, but it's not incredibly common, especially considering that it 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it wasn't a thing at all. The purpose of this article is to specifically review this slow rise of procedural integrity and then extend that information about errors of commission and omission. But like I said, I more care about their recommendations to practitioners in the end. So what are their results? I'm going to skip past a lot of their data collection and things like that because to me it just wasn't highly relevant to the point I was trying to make. It's a good article. It's a fairly easy read if you want to tackle it yourself. But their results was basically that fidelity was still being underreported. Now it's still growing in popularity. So the data confirms the statement that I said earlier, but it's still fairly underreporting. And what was interesting is that they also noted that in some articles there was a higher risk for fidelity errors, meaning there was more than one behavioral intervention in place at a time, and fidelity was still underreported on those higher risk articles. So one approach to take from the research perspective would actually be not requiring fidelity to be tracked in every single article and only tracked in articles where the risk is really high. So let's say you have an article and it's a simple DRA, right? Contingent on target behavior, break is provided for 5 minutes. That's the only intervention in place. We're not even worried about extinction, right? Contingent on behavior, break is applied. In that scenario, fidelity might not be that important to track in the research article because it's basically assumed that if you're publishing and you have the resources to publish, et cetera, you probably have pretty good fidelity. That's a low risk article. Now let's take, for example, the augmented competing stimulus analysis. In that assessment, you have multiple different things going at once. You have non-contingent reinforcement being applied, you have contingent prompting, you have praise, you have different items being switched in, you have a lot of different moving pieces. Fidelity is much more at risk there because there's more things to think about and more things to worry about. The authors, however, found that even in those high-risk articles, fidelity is being underreported, and somewhat more interestingly, it seems that errors are increasing over the years. Now, I think this is personally more of an artifact of procedural fidelity becoming more valuable and more important. I may burn some bridges with this, but I would hazard a guess that some of the early procedural fidelity data was, did everything go as planned? Yep, check, look good, give them 100. That doesn't really fly anymore, right? Procedural fidelity now is, did they do step 1, step 2, step 3, step 10 all correctly? Tally that out of 10. What I'm saying is that it's getting a lot more sensitive. And so, in my opinion, I don't think the errors are increasing. I think that the sensitivity of our data management techniques are increasing and finding differences in the amount of errors. And basically what I'm saying is that it always was probably rough, but our data is becoming more sensitive. Now, that being said, fidelity isn't at a crisis, right? It's not like all of our research can't be believed. We have really solid fidelity as a field because we focus so much on these easy to follow simple task analyses. But all that being said, what does that mean for us, the practitioner? Let's go back to what are the recommendations. We're not just worried about that, generally speaking, the applied science. So what does that mean for the practitioner? It means that supervision and observation is more and more important as a behavior analyst. Errors in research are challenging, right? They screw up with our research method. They do detract from a client's quality of life. But generally speaking, they're controlled. Even errors are controlled, and it's easy to bounce back from because you have less variables rolling in the way. Not really the case in clinical work. In clinical work, you're looking at differing amounts of hours, differing amounts of text. Maybe the caregivers say, this is working well, this isn't, so they want to focus on this. They're not really interested in focusing on that thing. And then suddenly you add errors into the mix, and then they say, why am I even coming all of these days to actually help? Like, all of these things compound in the clinical world, and variables become more and more challenging to deal with. And so fidelity becomes, it's just, you don't want to add fidelity as an additional variable to consider, right? If you can take a variable off the table, meaning all of your behavioral interventions are being described as planned, fidelity is the way to do that. And just know that all things going crazy, at least your interventions are being prescribed as planned. I also would argue that fidelity errors are probably the most common reason behavior interventions fail. Now, you know me, I'm a huge ABA nerd. I love to get into details. I love my resurgences and my renewals. I love competing versus match stimuli assessments, all of those things. However, oftentimes in the clinical world, behavioral interventions are somewhat straightforward, right? You have a behavior reduction plan, you have a behavior acquisition plan, and you're building skills to replace those challenging behaviors. And then it's not working. And you have to decide, you have to problem solve, why is this thing not working? I would argue the most common reason is simply because it's not being prescribed, it's not being applied as prescribed. There's fidelity errors. And it's challenging to keep track of those, right? It's challenging when you have 5 to 6 different techs on one case. It's challenging hell when you have one tech on the case. It's challenging when you're the direct implementer. But it still is important. And just because it's challenging doesn't mean we can just ignore it. It has such a big effect on our clients and on their overall success. Quick pause here for a second so I can tell you about something that's going to benefit you massively. You can probably tell that I read a lot of research just to produce this podcast and also just to keep my head above water in my clinical work. See, I'm always looking for the most efficient, quickest, and most practitioner yet also evidence-based way to solve the clinical challenges in front of me. However, as you know, quick and research don't always go hand in hand, and that's why I created the Solving Clinical Challenges with Research course to teach you an efficient 20 to 30 minute method to access, utilize, and identify research articles as well as summarizing them so that you can have the best information possible to solve your clinical challenges. This 2 CEU course is completely free for podcast listeners. Just go to behavioristbookclub.com/solving. behavioristbookclub.com/solving to get your free 2 CEU course. Back to the podcast. So, fidelity errors, you gotta focus on them. They're so important as a supervisor because it's oftentimes the easiest route to solve a problem. So what are the barriers? As a practitioner, I look at fidelity all the time. And over the last multiple years as a supervisor, I've come to realize that it's not always easy to stay on top of these things, and it's not always easy to actually track fidelity in a more formal manner. So I went and I thought about my experience, and I came up with 5 barriers, give or take, to tracking fidelity. But I will tell you, as I was going through these barriers, I was like, oh, there's another one. This is an exhaustive list, but to me, these are my biggest 5 challenges with tracking fidelity. The first one is time, technology, and simply materials. So this is where we talk about the fear of correcting behavior. Maybe you're identifying a fidelity issue, but you don't want to be the person who stops session in the middle of when your tech is implementing and say, hey, we need to change it like this, do it like that. So maybe it's just a fear of correcting. Maybe it's the focus and attention. You're in the middle of an intervention. You're doing all these things, etc. You're moving. Oh, let me stop, kill all my momentum, have a conversation with my tech about why that was or wasn't right, and then continue moving forward. It's simply a focus thing. You're not focusing on fidelity, and that's going to bite you in the ass because eventually fidelity is going to go haywire, and then you're going to have to focus on it. Time. Not enough supervision time or spending enough time or spending too much time on other tasks. This is where time management starts to get into play. If you're spending 25 hours writing one behavior plan, you probably aren't going to have time to track fidelity. So how are you spending your time, and are you giving fidelity the attention it deserves on the priority list? Like I said, nobody cares about fidelity when it's all 100%. But you do care about fidelity when you can't figure out why a behavior spikes and you're trying to figure out if you need to change the function-based intervention, conduct additional functional analysis, or just figure out if fidelity is off and that's why behavior has come back. Technology. So when I say technology, the need to create data sheets, graphs, spend time with a paper and pencil, checking things off, building task analyses, building protocols. This is something that I think doesn't get talked about enough in this conversation, is that when you're tracking fidelity, that inherently implies that you have a task analysis to that procedure. You have a protocol for the behavior that you're wanting to track, and you've written it down, and you've explained it, and you've role-played it with the technician. Oftentimes, that is exactly where we want to be when we're designing these protocols and behavioral interventions. But I would also say, oftentimes, we're not there as behavior analysts in busy clinical world. I know there have absolutely been times when instead of sitting down and typing up a 45-minute, two-page document on how I want them to modify the text behavior, I simply give them feedback verbally and then model it for them, and then they're on their way. It's faster, it's more efficient, and it doesn't really lend well to procedural integrity, right? Because it's not written down, it's not clear. So when it comes to making graphs and data sheets, you got to write a protocol with it. And that takes time that sometimes we as behavior analysts feel like we don't have. We already talked about the fear of correcting behavior. And finally, the last one I would say is focus and attention. So giving plenty of feedback, but not taking the data. Oftentimes, it's not even required by insurance, so, you know, who cares? That's a hard one, right? Because when you consider it, when you consider the additional time that it's going to take the data, to build the protocols and things like that, it is going to cost you more on the front end, but it saves you hours on the back end. Consider this situation. You're working with a client, and you've put in a basic behavioral reduction based on your functional analysis. With that, you're building skills. Everything's going smoothly until 3 weeks down the line when everything stops going smoothly and starts to fall apart. Okay, what are you going to do? There's multiple different levers to pull. You can look at the home life, you can look at medical, you can look at relationships with the technicians, you can look at a variety of different environmental factors, and then finally, you can also look at your behavioral intervention. Did you miss the function? Did you think it was break and instead it's break to attention, right? Is there some error there? Is there some technological error that you made that you need to then go back and fix? So then you start making your rounds and you start trying to figure things out. You spend time talking to caregivers. You spend time talking to techs. You observe the session. You redo your functional analysis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's all taking hours and hours of your time, just for you to learn that what happened is the tech didn't really understand the behavioral intervention and was reinforcing a different behavior and not reinforcing your functional communication response. Fidelity error. Yes, it takes time at the beginning, but damn, you save so much time when you're not having issues and you're not having those fidelity errors, not having to run around and waste time and do new functional analyses. So, we've talked about barriers. Now let's get to solutions. I want to just, all of these, they take more time. They take your attention, but it's worthwhile because fidelity matters. And that's the best way to actually start taking fidelity data yourself, is to realize how important it is. So first things first, have flexible data sheets. In my opinion, you shouldn't have a specific fidelity data sheet for each intervention for each client. It just gets too much. If you have 2 to 3 behavioral interventions running at one time, then that means you're going to have 3 separate fidelity data sheets for one client, and then you multiply that over 10 different clients, and now you have 30 fidelity data sheets. That's ridiculous. It's just too much. So try and keep your data sheets flexible and your graphing methodology flexible as much as possible. So this means instead of writing out each and every step, you're instead have a blank page with maybe lines in it to say, like, this step one, write it in. Accuracy, step two, accuracy, step three, accuracy. Basically, not filling in the information so you can stay flexible and thus keep the same data sheet as you go from client to client. Encourage self-reporting and delegating, whether it be a group chat with your techs or just spending a decent amount of time or weekly supervisions. Consistently talk about fidelity with your technicians so that they feel comfortable self-reporting it or knowing that they didn't do something right and they need more assistance with it. Here's another one I might get reamed for, but I like to draw fidelity graphs by hand. I'm focused on speed here, not formal submissions to JABA. So let's say I have some fidelity data sheets that I kept flexible on the side or in another notebook. Let's just draw a graph by hand, snap a picture on the phone, and now you remember exactly where your data was and where it's at, so you can graph it on Excel later when you have time, or just leave it digitally as a picture on your phone. The key here is that you're looking at it, not that you're getting something ready to publish to insurance. And finally, like I said, you have to understand how massively this can change your decision-making process. I've said it once, and I'll say it again, and I'll say it till the end of time. The most common error is fidelity. Fun fact, I think the second most common error is rapport and relationship building. But fidelity is simply almost always the culprit in these behavioral intervention plans, because we as behavior analysts like to make things way too complicated for no reason. It's just crucially important that you focus on fidelity from the get-go, so these conversations are consistently happening, so that as soon as it dips, you're able to be proactive instead of reactive, running around, chasing text, trying to figure out what's going on. So there you have it. That's the end of our podcast. It would mean the world to me if you commented or shared, or however you're interacting with this content. Subscribe if you're on a podcast platform. If you are available, give a review to this podcast. Give it 5 stars if you love it. Give me feedback if not. I read every single one, and it does a ton to boost the visibility of content like this in the overall algorithm. If you want to continue engaging with the Behaviorist Book Club, the best place to go is the ABA Cafe Facebook group. You can find it just by typing in the ABA Cafe into your Facebook search bar. It is a group of research-minded practitioners engaging and collaborating together to become better behavior analysts through our application of practitioner-focused research. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.